Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to have on the program today Richard Wilson, professor of music on the Mary Conover Mellon Chair here at Vassar College, and soon to become professor emeritus after 50 years of teaching here. Earlier this month, the entire Vassar community turned out to congratulate Mr. Wilson on his upcoming retirement and wish him well. These festivities included two weekends of concerts featuring colleagues in the music department. Richard's complete opus numbers over 100 compositions, including the opera Ethelred the Unready, first performed in Symphony Space in New York in 2011. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. I'm really excited to have you here.
You didn't mention that we're next-door neighbors.
Oh, yes. And we're next-door neighbors and friends, so... Your colleagues premiered one of your compositions at your retirement concert, Charades. Todd Croak performed it on December 10th. And I took this as a sign that you're not going out quietly, literally, that you intend to go on composing. So is composition going to be a part of your future?
Well, nobody knows for sure what's going to be part of their future. It's not my intention to stop composing, but the impulse has to be there. And if it's not, then it's not a good idea to do it, I don't think. It's easier to, say, practice the piano every day because there's certain physical warm-up things you can do. It's a little harder to do that with composition, although I do find that sometimes revising or making a version of something I've already done gets me going, and then then I'm on the move and maybe we'll shift into doing something brand new.
So thinking along these same lines, at this juncture of your career, with so many years of composition behind you, has composing become easier? Is there a certain momentum that you acquire as a practicing artist as the years behind you accumulate and you've got more experience to draw on? In terms of motivation, do you find yourself composing all the time, or do you find it easier? I suppose that's the question.
It's hard to answer that. Mm-hmm. I've never found it very easy, though some pieces do get themselves written more readily than others. And I've never been sure whether the results are in proportion to that in some way. I mean, are they better or worse if they if they went fast? I don't know. It's really hard to say. But I don't think I'm the kind of composer who is composing all the time. I don't have music running through my head, at least not my music. I may have the music that I'm practicing on the piano at the moment, being Schubert impromptus. I have those running through my head. I do have music running through my head, though. And at the gym, I was listening to Horowitz playing Scarlatti, and then that was running through my head for the next 24 hours. But I compose when I feel like composing, and that's pretty much how it is.
Yeah. The follow-up to that was, I remember Harry Roseman talking about facility in art, and he was talking about talent sort of generally, and that one can have a talent for rendering things, for drawing, say, rendering things well. But for Harry, that kind of facility can get in the way of creating art, and that the medium always wants to sort of resist your facility. For him, at least that was the case. You're struggling with the medium always, in a sense, and the medium is sort of teaching you. So maybe it's good it isn't easy, you know. That
some composers had enormous facility and quality at the same time.
Yeah.
Mozart, Mendelssohn, they couldn't not compose, and what they did was, and they both died so young, and they just, and Schubert, I mean, the unbelievable fluency of those three composers, all of whom died young. The three that I mentioned wrote as so young music of the highest quality, and it just flowed out of them. Effortless, it would seem. Richard Strauss wrote all the time, but the music, which I love at its best, but it's not always top drawer. But again, it flowed out of him. Someone like Copland, I think that wasn't the case. He didn't write that much music, and at a certain age, younger than I am now, he stopped. And the actual number of pieces is not so very great, but I think he was a meticulous worker. But there was effort involved.
Yeah. You're both a performer, a concert pianist, and a composer, and I wonder, does one inform the other much, going both ways? And I suppose I'm wondering more about whether composing music makes one a better performer or interpreter. I mean, it would be obvious that as a composer, it helps to know whether a piece that you're composing is performable. So the fact that you're a pianist, and when you compose for piano anyway, it must tell that you're composing. But does being a composer help your performance? Is there an influence both ways?
Well, you hope it does.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of marvelous performers who are not composers, so it's not essential. Although in the old days, in the previous centuries, they tended to be the same person. Mm-hmm. Composers also performed. But that stopped, I guess, in the 20th century. You have a composer like Schoenberg who never performed.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot Carter never performed. On the other hand, it's kind of hard to think of people who didn't do at some point. I mean, I mentioned Richard Strauss. He was a great conductor, but also a very fine pianist early on in his his days, and would accompany his wife in song recitals. So he could do that. I don't know about Mahler actually doing much public performing since his school days. Stravinsky, of course, played and conducted. So it's awfully good to have a hand in both activities, mm-hmm. I think. But how they influence each other, it's kind of hard to say.
Performance is interpretation in part, isn't it? So understanding the music is a big part of it, I would expect.
Yes, of course, yeah. Yes. And I think when I stop and think about it, the training of some of the very best performers does include a period of composing. Whether they continued it or not is another matter. But it is certainly the case that I'm thinking about George Schulte saying that he wrote a symphony when he was in his conservatory days, but didn't choose to pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
George Sell, my hero from Cleveland, was considered to be a prodigy composer, and at 14 wrote completely finished works that are still performable, and he was maybe going to continue that until he got closely working with Richard Strauss and perceived a difference between his composing and Richard Strauss's, and so he chose to focus on conducting to our great benefit. But his Variations for Orchestra, a piece I'm pretty familiar with, is excellent and was written when he was a teenager.
When my dissertation advisor, Bob Hanning, retired, I remember him quipping that the only thing he'd rather do than teach is not teach. He was happy, very happy to retire. So are you looking forward to having more time to devote to not teaching, I suppose is the question. I mean, whether you plan to spend the time composing or not. Teaching is very time-consuming, of course, so have you thought about how you're going to spend your time?
I am still trying to finish up the grades for one of my three classes, and
yes,
that involves some close grading of music, fugues that are coming out of my counterpoint class. So it's rather surprising to me that I have made no plans and haven't thought ahead whatsoever to what it's going to feel like not teaching, since I've been doing it for 50 plus years. And I decided to stop because I thought it was a little rude to stay beyond 50 years. I'm staying one semester beyond 50 years at Vassar. I had taught somewhat in graduate school also, but I'm sure that the realization of it will hit me in a few weeks, and then I will ask my wife, what do you think we should do? But that kind of conversation has barely been hinted at because of the, I would say, pleasant commotion surrounding my retirement and the concerts, some of which I've had to participate in, so that means going to New York and having rehearsals, and I'm just recovering from all of that, really, and I love the teaching, I love my students and my colleagues, goodness, I have a wonderful set of colleagues in the music department, so I'll miss all of that, of course, but I have the intention to continue performing on the piano. Whether it is in New York, I've given in the past several concerts at the Kosciuszko Foundation or at the Century Association, And I do intend to continue doing that and to collaborate with various performers, singers, and instrumentalists. All of that is, I haven't considered stopping any mm-hmm. of that. And where appropriate, we will include a piece of mine, and sometimes mm-hmm. I'm sure it will be a new piece. It just yeah. none of that is very clear in my head at the moment.
Wonderful. So you've been here 50 years, and I expect things have changed a lot in the course of that time. So can you talk about how perhaps the music department's changed? And then the institution also, I mean, you date back to before we went co-ed, yes? So you must remember what it was like when we were an all-women's school and then the transition.
Well, I remember it very clearly, yeah. of course. When I came to Vassar, when I accepted the job, it never really occurred to me that Vassar would change. Mm-hmm. It didn't occur to me. But I was listening, I think it was in November, it was a Friday evening, and I was listening to WQXR on the FM station, and at about the 9 o'clock news, the mm-hmm. news break, they said, Vassar is considering moving to New Haven and joining Yale University. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's odd. I've just got here, and this is certainly strange. So I called one of my senior colleagues, mm-hmm. Earl Groves, mm-hmm. who had just lovingly built a house, actually quite near where I live now. And he put a heart and soul into this house. And so when I said, Vassar may move to New Haven, of course, his first reaction is, what about my house?
Yeah.
But there were other... certainly other implications to all of mm-hmm. this. It's so hard to remember exactly the details, but I, as I can reconstruct it in my head, there had been an announcement of a special faculty meeting mm-hmm. on the Saturday morning, and people were a little puzzled because faculty never met on Saturday morning, but I'm hearing this on the radio on Friday evening, and mm-hmm. the next morning is this gathering. A lot of people came who never went to faculty meetings because they were curious. And of course, by that time, the word had gotten out. Yeah. It's been on the radio.
Yeah.
So we knew what to expect. And President Simpson announcing this plan to study the possibility. Mm-hmm. It was essentially an invitation from Yale, and we were going to consider it.
Mm-hmm.
But to follow that along a little bit, I had occasion within that first year or so, I'm date exactly not quite in my head, but mm-hmm. I had occasion to represent Vassar up at the New England Conservatory when mm-hmm. they instituted Gunther Schuller as the new president of the conservatory. And so I'm up there in a academic processional, mm-hmm. you know, representing Vassar. And I'm talking with the dean, Luther Noss, of the Yale School of Music. Mm-hmm. And this conversation is witnessed by one of my professors from Harvard, Elliot Forbes. And Luther Noss tells me that it's a done deal.
Uh-huh.
It's all settled, wrapped, mm-hmm. signed and sealed, uh-huh. that Vassar would be coming to New Haven. Of course, we, meaning those of us on the faculty who were not in more secure positions, that is, we didn't have tenure,
mm-hmm.
were very dubious that we were going to go along on this trip. Mm-hmm. I mean, that we couldn't really imagine that Yale was going to incorporate the entire Vassar faculty.
Yes.
So we were a little bit nervous about this, and of course, one looked about for alternative job opportunities.
Yeah.
Well, another man, just recently died, Arthur Hadley. He's an old gentleman, he was about 90 or so, and I happened to have lunch with him.
Mm-hmm.
And his grandfather had been president of Yale, and his mother had been on the Vassar board, so he had a foot in each institution. And he told me that he was the one who told Kingman Brewster, the president of Yale, that the deal was off. And he said that Kingman Brewster went up and smoked because he thought it had been agreed to.
Uh-huh.
And so we came that close, in other words, yeah. to going. And it became clear to us all that if the Yale arrangement fell through, mm-hmm. we would go co-ed. The president announced that. President Simpson said, and this was a board decision, the Board of Trustees had decided that if that we had to have men at Vassar. And the whole question was simply how to do it and whether we would go co-ed in the way that we have, or would there be something called coordinate education, which was a separate school for men under the auspices of Vassar and taught by a separate faculty, which was a totally irrational unrealistic kind of thing. And so this was put to a vote. The faculty, which voted overwhelmingly for co-ed, since obviously they didn't want a competing faculty chosen to teach the men. It would have made no sense. And so that is sometimes portrayed as a vote on the part of the faculty in favor of co-ed versus staying all women, but that was not the issue.
Well, interesting.
That
That's
was
very
never
interesting.
The question. The decision to have men was made by the board, and the faculty chose the more rational way of doing it. And then my wife, Dee, was in the last all-female class, 69, and we started graduating men after that. So that's, I suppose, the most tangible or visible change to Vassar in this 50-year period is the going of co-ed and what I would, I think, the success of that venture. Now, people always wish, I suppose they wish that the numbers were more equal, 50-50, and I don't think they are at very many places. So
interesting. From Yale, we used to hear that we almost merged with Vassar, but they stood us up on the altar, is the way, way they used to put it.
Somebody will sometime write the history of this, and there are people who know more about it than I do. But certainly the students at Vassar were 98% in favor of going to Yale. And the faculty, I would say, was about evenly divided. It was the alumni who torpedoed the idea. Of course, when you think back on it, we have such a beautiful campus, which we would have given up in favor of a high rise in New Haven. At the time I'm speaking, I don't think the beauty and all the virtues of a campus were as well appreciated as they became after the Columbia riots and all of the uprisings and the ability to achieve a peaceful environment for learning, that became much more valued.
Of course, Yale went co-ed also at the same time.
Well, that was part of the calculation that I think the Vassar trustees understood, that as these men's colleges became co-ed, and you know, Amherst and Williams, and of course Princeton and Yale and
Harvard,
and Harvard too, when that happened, Vassar was going to have a harder time attracting the quality of women that it had been used to. And also, there had to be some institution to grab the men who didn't get into those places because they went co-ed. So it was a rational thing, not always appreciated, because I think there was still a good deal of resistance among the women of the alumni. But it wasn't as bad as going to New Haven, so it was a the lesser of two evils.
So has the music department then evolved over the time you've been here? I mean, music has evolved, certainly in music education, haven't they? I mean, you know, we're in the digital age now, of course, so recording technologies have changed dramatically, but has the department changed over the years?
Well, because of the co-ed, of course, remember the singing groups were always a big part of it, and going gradually co-ed is a challenge for a mixed choir because you don't have enough men. And so there were growing pains, of course, at that time. And whether it's connected to co-ed or not, we have a much larger jazz program. I can't say that it's a direct result, but it's in fact the case that we have both small and large jazz ensembles under departmental supervision with a very fine faculty member in charge, and none of that was true when I came. And we also cover all of the instruments, well, I mean all of the standard classical instruments, which we didn't in, in those days. In the first years it was violin, cello, flute, but then we expanded that to all of the woodwinds and brass instruments, and we have two percussion teachers, which we didn't mm-hmm. have in those days. So all of that's happened. And in the last 20 years, maybe the last 10 years particularly, the orchestra has... There was always an orchestra, but it was small. Mm-hmm. And now it's a very impressive, still 100% students, not any ringers. It's really quite an impressive outfit. And then all the choral, all of this, these performing programs are flourishing.
Yeah, the voice programs are just absolutely yeah. wonderful. And they pack Skinner Hall anymore. It's a standing yeah. room only sometimes, both Drew Minter and Christine Howlett.
No, we have a wonderful faculty. It was always a good department going way back because mm-hmm. Vassar really had a school of music when it started mm-hmm. that didn't last too many years, but it was possible to get a music degree from Vassar back in the period after 1860.
Yeah, way back. Same with the art department. The arts sort of generally were very well supported in the 19th century by the institution. So, you know, in a sense, we stand on the shoulders of the individuals who were here before us, in music and art both, who developed that early arts curriculum at the institution. And that's certainly the case, I can say, for studio art and art history, where we're very cognizant of the legacy we've inherited and the need to preserve that legacy and see to it that college administrators and others recognize that there's something important and excellent here that's been built up with great care over the years that needs to be taken care of and supported. So the question is, how do we do that? Do we need to be institutional historians to some extent? You have that reputation, in a sense, of being an institutional historian at faculty meetings. I mean, when something comes up, you know, curricular change and some memory is required, you will often stand up and fill in how this has been done before and what we've done before. So the question is one about institutional memory, that it seems to me for both of our departments it's very important to have that.
Well, my memory for the first 10 years at Vassar is much better than for my most recent 10 years,
yeah.
so
uh-huh.
I can, I think, reasonably accurately report on that. Whether it's of any interest to the rest of the faculty, I'm not sure,
yeah.
but I have done that unsolicited on a number of occasions,
yeah.
but it can be tiresome. I have had to watch it in department meetings where someone thinks of something we might do, and I say, well, we did that
yes.
35 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was a big failure,
yes.
and there's no reason to... That can be very irritating.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
So, yeah, so I try to bite my yeah. tongue a bit that way, because, after all, yeah. new people trying an old idea may work out
yeah.
better,
yeah.
but it's very hard to find true innovation when you're talking about curricular matters and department policy
yeah,
and so on.
Sun, yeah.
It's hard to innovate there. But the main thing in a department I found is we have frequent brief meetings. Every 2 weeks we meet for an hour
mm-hmm.
and we keep minutes so we know what we're doing, we think what we've done. And we enforce the length of the meeting by having a student recital at the end of it so mm-hmm. that we have to stop and go and hear our students.
Uh-huh.
This wasn't my idea, but was the brilliant idea of Robert Middleton, who mm-hmm. died recently but was a wonderful colleague and a very good music department chair. And he had grown tired of meetings that just went on and on and on, so the way to stop it was to have a recital mm-hmm. where we were really obliged to go and hear our students. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been good, and we've continued his idea all these years because it keeps the core of the faculty informed as to what's mm-hmm. going on, what the issues are, and they have a feeling of participation, and so I think that's been good. People who were great in the history of our programs, George Sherman Dickinson mm-hmm. has two things that are really remarkable. One of them is that he collected the main holdings in our really world-class music library.
Yes.
He was traveling around Europe. He had found the funds to do this, and often in the 1930s when Depression was on, he was able to acquire things that wouldn't be affordable in a different era. And so that's one thing. And the other thing is that he basically achieved the music building. That is, he mm-hmm. got the funding. There was some resistance from the college to have a music building, and they said it was building be too expensive to maintain, so he went back to the donor and got a separate fund to maintain the building. So he was a very stubborn fellow, and he participated heavily in the design of the building so that the performance wing can be separated with pairs of double doors, sound insulated, in other words, so that the academic part, this classrooms and so on, are separate sound-wise from the practice rooms. And this was a very, very good design. And, of course, it has a beautiful recital hall, one of the best in this whole area, including New York City. So for a 500-seat hall with wonderful acoustics and wonderful design, it really can't be beat. And we get this kind of comment all the time from people coming up to perform there, that they want to come back.
Yeah. Our program is a free program for people in the community, which is quite wonderful. So
we wanted to keep that way, although there's always a temptation when resources are scarce that people see that as a possible source of income. But our argument is that the management of a concert series itself is costly, and it probably wouldn't make that much of a difference. And then we love the fact that the community can come, and we have a very loyal community audience.
Yeah, that and the program at the Loeb Center are both really quite important elements of the sort of town gown outreach, that we add something substantial to the community. So you mentioned the music library. Both music and art have departmental libraries, and I sometimes wonder if that isn't why our departments sort of shine the way they do to some extent, or why we both have departments that are really communities, and that the library is an institution that helps build that kind of intellectual community, and certainly provides memory, not just institutional memory, but a memory of the culture itself and the disciplines. And it's a beautiful library, I have to say. The music library is just stunning, and has its own special collections and an instrument collection.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. It's a very big part of Vassar and of the Vassar Music Department.
Yeah.
I think when you were talking about the future of the arts and so on, I'm a little concerned that the new curricular plan that was voted some weeks ago, it's going to be very important to not have that be detrimental to the arts. I'm speaking from the point of view that there was no one from the arts on the committee that drew up the plan, and the limitations on student programs, which are understandable. I mean, I do understand that some students take on too many units and so on, but the limit to 4.5 units is really going to hit the arts programs that are for a half unit harder than any other part of the curriculum. And I just don't, I mean, I'm leaving, so but I hope that accommodations are made to protect the arts programs. And I'm talking about music performance, but of course dance, theater, studio art. They all should be concerned that this not be a pivot away from the arts in favor of STEM subjects. I mean, we're naturally, as far as the science building next to us is concerned, we have some concerns that it emits a low tone of a specific pitch, which is a little annoying.
Literally, you mean makes the sound from the roof.
Yes,
and yes, it's not a green building and a quiet building.
It's not environmentally friendly from the sound point of view.
No.
So that's a concern, and I don't know whether they'll be able to fix that. Yeah. We can hear it in the recital hall,
which is not a good idea.
On the other hand, the access to Skinner through the building, I think, is a big success.
Yes, and it makes a nice venue for maybe even intermissions. I was thinking if you could serve champagne or whatever at the, you know,
possibly,
at the one end.
Yes, and also Eduardo Navega has been having some noontime chamber music concerts in the Bridge building, which I think is a wonderful idea. So, and we're so glad that the noise of construction is over. So the building is, I think, is good for Skinner and for the music program because of the access. And, and as you say, that we have no intermission place for people to go. And so if that were to turn out to work, that would be great.
There's a reason why Matthew Vassar himself was so adamant about the place of the arts in the curriculum, and that is the beauty of an undergraduate education, is that students can sample. They needn't have made up their minds when they come in as first-year students what they want to do yet. That's something, for later on. And you yourself started out as a med student, yes? And a pre-med program as an undergraduate, yes?
I think it goes back to Sputnik.
Uh-huh.
And my high school science programs were enhanced because of the whole business about Sputnik and the fear that U.S. science training had fallen behind the Russians. So
yes. I remember, well, I got a microscope for Christmas in 1958.
So. Well, that's the idea. Yeah. We were given strong preparations. In my case, it was more chemistry and physics than biology. And so I thought, first of all, my career ambition started with wanting to be a professional magician.
Mm-hmm.
But when I realized that vaudeville was not a promising kind of thing, I thought, then I always did music, of course. Yeah. And so there was that, but I worried about being able to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around, and doctors seemed to be able to make a living, so I thought, well, maybe do that. And so I did okay in my college science courses and decided to prepare for medical school, but not to major in any of the sciences. And I wound up majoring in music, which was a logical thing, though it didn't at the time seem foreordained. But I got into medical school.
Mm-hmm.
The telegram admitting me to Harvard Medical School hangs in our basement bathroom, in case anyone wants to verify that I did get into medical school. But I got this fellowship to go to Europe, and I asked them for a year to think about it. And when I thought about it, it seemed... I realized I had done organic chemistry in the summer in Cleveland, and a month or so after doing that, and doing quite well at it, I realized I'd forgotten every single thing about it. And that was an alarming sign. I thought, if I can't remember a month later any of these reactions that I had so carefully memorized, maybe this was not a good thing for me to be a doctor. So I feel I have saved a lot of lives by not going to medical school.
Do no harm, right?
I think that's it, and so on. But yes, I was in a situation that many of our undergraduates are in, and that is that they really don't know, as freshmen, sophomores, even juniors, they don't really know where they're going to wind up.
We've already talked about transitioning to being retired, and I'm nearing that age myself, and I wonder how difficult it is for people who have been in the academy to do this, because in a sense, it's not just the 50 years that you've been here at Vassar. We've been in the academy in a way since we entered kindergarten, yes? And the years always started in September, ended in June. Looking at life after retirement, wondering about it, I envy the British in these circumstances. I mean, for an academic, Oxbridge was founded on a monastic model, and emeriti faculty can remain part of the communities insofar as they're often made fellows. Sometimes they continue to collect salaries of a kind. They certainly have their rank. They usually will have an office. They're allowed to teach or lecture. But we don't have that luxury with Americans. Teaching, even in higher education, is basically a job, and you retire from it like everyone else does. So the question is, how do we remain part of the community? And retired people have a lot to offer the community yet. And I know we do have an association of retired faculty that we can belong to. And so I don't know what the question is here that I'm getting at, but well, I wonder if you're looking forward to being part of that group. And then I would expect you'd be part of other groups also, professional groups in the music world. You'd have those communities to belong to yet. So, you know, the question is, how do we contribute to the community after we're retired? By just being ourselves and being here, by talking with one another? I mean, we've got a tremendous amount of institutional memory that can be applied in a positive way, I think. Administrators don't tend to look to retired faculty for advice, unfortunately. They don't tend to look to even senior faculty often for advice. They tend to accrue the youngest faculty members around them who are happy to agree with whatever policies they're looking for support for. But we have something to contribute, you know, with the years' experience we have. And do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think I've observed two attitudes about this. I've certainly had colleagues who, when they retired, wanted to get far away from Vassar, not because they didn't like it at Vassar, but they didn't want to seem to be ghosts hanging around, you know, and they simply wanted to start up in a new environment, and so that's one attitude. Yeah. And then there is the opposite, who want to remain part of the Vassar family and just simply stop teaching. Mm-hmm. And, well, one of the things about being in music is that when you interact with musicians who are not part of an academic community, it's quite revealing how different their attitudes about many things are. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very close friends with Leon Botstein. He's been a college president since he was 23. So you might think of him as a creature of the academic world. But when he started conducting the American Symphony, he met a whole bunch of people who had nothing to do with the academic world. And their political views, their idea of what was a good joke, their religious devotions were just very revealing. And he felt suddenly this was a world that, you know, he's now interacting in this, in a way, with something so very different and almost alien to the academic world that he had spent so much time in. And I know that feeling because I've also, I do interact with groups of musicians that are out in the world, so to speak. I mean, they, if they're in New York, they may be playing Phantom of the Opera every night, and they're wonderful, wonderfully gifted musicians, but they don't think like academics. And so I'm aware of the problem that can, if you get too much in the academic world, that being released from it, you're really totally at sea. You don't know what's going on. So, but I do think it's very good that there is an association of emeriti here, because they can have meetings and talk and reminisce and also present their latest scholarship.
Yes, they do. I saw Karen Lusick present a few weeks ago.
This is a wonderful thing, and it's only, it's a result of a couple of people really wanting to make it happen, because it didn't always happen. And so I think that's very good.
We do live in a kind of hot house. I mean, it's the downside of the academy, and that, you know, you can become insular.
But I'd rather have spent the most of my life in the academic world than not. And on campus rather than not. Important as it is to understand what the knot is, but I'm very grateful for having had the opportunity to be part of an academic community.
And then you always have the influx of students who keep you young, in a sense, don't they? And you've had remarkable students over the years, and some of them have gone on to become musicians and composers,
It's true, but I've also had the children of my students. And worried that it would come to a point where I would have grandchildren as my first students. It's almost come to that. And so that was another impulse to stop.
So shall we play a piece, one of your compositions?
Well, we could. And I guess it's like having 120 children, which is your favorite child. I think maybe I would suggest that you play a piece for flute, oboe, and clarinet called Gnomix. G-N-O-M-I-C-S. I don't remember why I called it that, but it was written at the request of a man named Meyer Kupferman, who used to live in Rhinebeck. He's quite an accomplished composer, older than I, by a good solid generation, I'd say. And he's not living anymore, but he played the clarinet, and he always wanted to increase the repertoire for chamber music involving the clarinet, so I wrote it at his behest. But there is a wonderful recording, and if you have access to it, why don't we play that?
Yeah, we'll do.
Thank you.
Your pieces often have a sort of whimsy about them, a sense of humor a bit, and the titles you give them certainly do, yes?
Well, I have written deadly serious music, yeah. But there's a limit to my patience with deadly seriousness, and so I may revert to a lighter touch.
Yeah. And I know you're a great Jack Benny fan, yes?
Very much a Jack Benny fan.
Yeah, me too.
I'm obsessive about Jack Benny and his writers, who were wonderful.
Yeah.
So he's really a committee. He delivered and had the timing and everything and the voice and the diction, but he relied on some very talented writers whose humor stands up 60 years later.
So I'd like to thank you, Richard, for visiting with us here on the Library Cafe to talk about your career and music.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Thank you.